NBC presents the War Telescope. Each week at this time, the National Broadcasting Company calls in one of its reporters overseas to give you a review of the week to come. Today we shall take you to London for the report of John McVane. But first, here is a brief review of the latest news. Marshal Stalin has just announced another day of sweeping victories on the Eastern Front. Soviet troops invading German Silesia from southwestern Poland are forcing the battle line to within 200 miles of Berlin. And with East Prussia under attack from east and south, other Russian armies are aiming spearheads toward the old Polish corridor and Danzig. On the western front, the American 7th Army is confronting a determined German drive barely 8 miles above the French city of Strasbourg. But in Luxembourg and Belgium, other American forces are whittling down the last of the Ardennes Bulge. And the British are biting deeper into a newly invaded zone of enemy territory from southeastern Holland. Heavy air attacks are striking western Germany. And on Luzon, American spearheads are 65 miles from Manila. But now for our direct report from London, we take you to NBC in London.
This is John McVane in London. American correspondents here keep in touch with opinion at home by various means. One is a daily issue of two or three mimeographed sheets that comes from the Ministry of Information. The sheets list radio talks and articles and headlines appearing in the press of New York, Chicago, Washington, and other cities. The idea is that in about 5 minutes you can get a general idea of what stories are appearing at home, what subjects are getting the biggest play, and what domestic radio commentators are discussing. Two or three weeks ago, one line caught my eye. I've forgotten who was the person named, and perhaps it's just as well. I stopped and looked twice. It said something like, "Charges Russian staging sit-down on Eastern Front." Some American, whether politician or publicist, I don't remember, was claiming that Moscow had decided not to fight the Germans anymore. He claimed American troops on the Western Front were being left in the lurch to do all the fighting by themselves. I hope that whoever it was has now condemned himself to sit for 16 hours a day in front of a large-scale map of Poland and Eastern Germany. I speak of this today because it sometimes seems as though some people who break into public print don't realize at this late date the importance of this war, not only to ourselves, but to all our allies. To believe that the Russians, for some obscure political end, were refusing to fight anymore is to expunge from your mind the last 3.5 years of the war. That Russia would forget its millions of dead, its wasted territories, and its purpose of removing once and for all the threat of Germany is a possibility so incredible that you wonder how anyone reached that conclusion. It's easier to understand war if you lay aside prejudice and look at the objectives, the ground over which the battle is being fought, and the other strictly military factors that determine the course of the conflict. The Russian winter offensive began at about the time, 2 weeks, one way or the other, that most observers expected. After the fall offensive was finished, the Russians, this winter as last winter, had to consolidate their gains. They had to re-equip their armies, build up shattered communications, and build up vast quantities, too, of supplies behind a new front that was far distant from the former bases. There's no mystery about it all. The Russians build up, launch an attack, and go as far and fast as they can before they're forced by space, supply problems, or the enemy's defenses to halt, re-equip, and build up for the next drive. It's gone like that ever since Stalingrad. Right now, the Russians are off on a push that will carry them deep into Germany before spring thaws or the growing stiffness of the German defenses make them pause and reorganize for the summer drive. Our own progress on the Western Front has moved in the same fashion. But there are important differences at this moment. We landed. From that moment on, our progress was determined by a problem the Russians have never had to encounter, supply lines that cross the seas. In Russia, you can take your new gun or your new tank as it comes off the factory assembly line, put it into a train and run that train right up to supply dumps near the front. When one of our tanks or guns comes off an assembly line, it goes into a train and perhaps covers a greater distance than from Russian factory to Russian front before it reaches an East Coast port. There, it must be taken from the train and placed in a ship. From the moment our tank enters the ship, it must undergo other delays, forming of convoys, a long sea passage. At the new port in Europe, the tank must again go through the process of out of the ship into the train. If the port is a French port, The tank may be on another long trip by land. Or the tank may have to compete with floods of other vital war material and food moving over a transport system that's been systematically bombed to pieces for nearly 5 years. If, on the other hand, the tank is landed at a British port, it may have to go by rail, be transshipped, and move by road, rail, or its own power when it reaches the continent. Those simple facts show that by the time an American tank reaches one of our divisions on the Western Front, it has probably traveled 3 or 4 times as far and undergone many more necessary but time-wasting movements than a new Russian tank. And that's a continuing handicap that our supply forces are faced with. So in Normandy, we had to build up our forces in the bridgehead before we could strike out of it. We had to wait until we had enough material at hand to free France. For we could get no last-minute supplies at short order. We could cut down the time from the factory to the front, but we could never cut it beyond a certain definite minimum. The other day, I read one American military expert, who should know better, putting forth the idea that we made a mistake in the first weeks of the bridgehead using tanks in small groups instead of one great mass. He should have known we couldn't use a mass of tanks until we had a mass of tanks there on the spot, or until we had the gasoline, the shells, and all the rest to make a breakthrough worthwhile. Anyway, when we had them, we used them and shot across France at just as great speed as the Russians are shooting across Poland now. When we outran our supplies and communications, we stopped. From that moment, last September, the situations on the East and West Front differed sharply. In the first place, ground. When the Russians halted last fall, they were on the great central Polish plain. The River Vistula and some smaller streams offered little natural barrier to aid the German defenders. Between the Vistula and Berlin, only the Oder showed as a slight military obstacle. Where were we? We were encountering the Germans along the spiny Vosges Mountains. Northward was the broken ground of the Luxembourg-German border, where you can stand and see one fold of hills enveloping the next. The Eifel Massif, the rough wooded hills and valleys, the rushing rivers, made military defense of Western Germany easy and inexpensive as compared with the eastern plains on which the Russians hovered. Only certain traditional gaps permitted the entry of large forces of troops into Western Germany. The Germans had always debouched into France through these gaps, and it was at these gaps that the Germans concentrated their massed defenses. If you look at the map, you'll see that in the north is Germany's greatest danger. There, Holland turns into the North German plain. The hills dwindle out. A powerful force that struck into North Germany could outflank the whole line of natural defenses stretching down to the Alps. Both sides saw the possibility and the danger. The strong British army took up the task. The other day, I read an article by a British military correspondent claiming we should mass our forces, give Montgomery's troops a chance, and strike through some active part of the front. The complaint was that in the long, strung-out front, Montgomery's men had been assigned a quiet sector. Well, the correspondent probably forgot that last fall we did mass our forces. Montgomery got the bulk of the supplies, all air aid, and the support of American airborne and other divisions to try the scheme of striking into the North German plain. The airborne divisions landed at Arnhem. The British Second Army got underway, but the Germans, too, had seen the danger. They'd massed their defending troops there. They wiped out the British 1st Airborne Division because the British Second Army got pinned down and couldn't come up in support. The attack never broke through and got rolling. When that attack failed, it became a question of gathering enough supplies and troops to roll over some part or parts of the long German defense lines, based, as I said before, not on a plain, but on hills, forests, and fast streams. Now two more factors came into play. Western Europe, where we're fighting, is drenched in alternate rain and snow, or covered with masses of sullen low cloud from October to March. On only 2 or 3 days a month does the sky clear up enough to use air power to a significant extent in aiding troops on the ground. In northeastern Europe, the ground is frozen. Snow remains snow, and for comparatively long periods shines white under clear skies. On the plains, German transport and troops are vulnerable to air attack. In the mountains, nestled in the woods or in some mountainside cranny, they're hard to find, still harder to attack. The net result is that we have trouble most of the time blasting out defending Germans with our planes. The Russians have trouble using their aircraft only for short periods and occasionally. The second factor is armor. It's on the plains that Armor can smash, run around, deploy, strike in its most efficient manner. We saw how the German Armor overran Poland early in the war. We're now seeing how the Germans are being beaten at their own game on exactly the same ground. In the 1940 Battle of France, the Germans could concentrate their armor in the hills and woods, then spring out and maneuver on the plains of Belgium and France. We've already beaten the Germans on the ground they conquered so swiftly in 1940. But nobody has yet in history won or lost lightning tank battles in the valleys and woods of Western Germany. The very ground works in favor of the German defenses. Another, but not so important factor, is that German tanks, like Russian tanks, are built to move more easily in the snow or soft ground than our own tanks. This and greater hitting power of the German tanks may give them slight advantages from time to time. Ordinarily, that wouldn't matter, but added to all other factors, it may sometimes become important. You may be wondering what all this amounts to, how it'll affect the future of the great final grapple with Germany. My own personal feeling is that a knowledge of the ground and the offensive problems will help you understand why we are, just now, taking one German village where the Russians are taking 50. In the Battle of France last summer, the American First Army had to fight harder, moved much slower, and did more real damage to the enemy than the brilliant tank sweep of the Third Army that for 5 weeks held the attention of the world. Yet both were equally important, and the role of both was determined by the ground over which they fought and the German defenses they encountered. In the same way today, our allies, the Russians, are achieving a glorious victory that should sweep the Germans from Poland and send them stumbling back toward the last desperate battle of Berlin and Central Germany. Yet during this winter, we will be slugging through the hills of Western Germany, killing Germans, weakening the army, pinning it down so it can't send divisions eastward to help against the Russians. It may be we'll find this weak spot. German commanders may weaken their forces on the Rhine to defend the Oder. If that happens, we too may burst through, with or without supporting aircraft, and cut into the heart of central and southern Germany. If no weak spot appears, we may not be able to get rolling until spring brings some clear sky and firm ground. When that moment comes, and we can throw all our land and air forces into the smash, you can be sure that nothing will stop us. Then we'll finish off Germany's western armies, while our Russian allies, with Berlin possibly safely under their belt, are harrying the remnant of the German armies of the east. Then, with Germany temporarily through as a military power, we can sit down with our allies and figure out how to make that state of affairs permanent. Perhaps the war and fire that'll run through Germany these coming months will kill for a generation or two the German urge for military conquest. But as long as Russia, France, and Britain, and America continue to agree on one basic principle, that Germany must be prevented from ever doing it again, fear will be lifted from the small and the great nations of Europe, and men can conduct their relationships with their neighbor nations on a basis of reason and understanding. It's a good thing to remember as the Big Three or the Big Four prepare to meet and perhaps do something about it. Meanwhile, all the reports say the Russian advance has given our troops a great morale boost. In a Stars and Stripes cartoon today, a couple of bearded, grimy American soldiers in the snowy woods of the Ardennes are looking at some distant figures. The man with the field glasses is saying to the doughboy with the automatic rifle, "Now hold it till I make sure they're Krauts. We don't want none of them Russians on our conscience." This is John McVane winding up this week's edition of NBC's War Telescope and returning you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
And again, here's a roundup of the afternoon's headlines. Moscow's 224 victory guns have fired a salute to another day of spectacular gains for the Red Army. Premier Stalin announces new successes in southern Poland, in Slovakia, and in Hungary. Russian troops are at the border of German Silesia, 200 miles from Berlin, and are invading East Prussia from the south and east. On Luzon in the Philippines, there is a renewed drive for Tarlac and Clark Field, which is midway between Lingayen Gulf and Manila. And yesterday's B-29 bombing of an aircraft plant in the Kobe-Osaka area of Japan is called the most successful super bomber mission to date. Over 300 direct hits on the sprawling target. During the past quarter hour, NBC has brought you the weekly War Telescope. Our reporter today was John McVane, speaking from London. Listen next week at this same time for the War Telescope. This is the National Broadcasting Company.